He died, my dad repeated in disbelief. No, my mom said again. No, 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 no. She dropped her head into her hands. I couldn't swallow. It had to be wrong. We had to be able to rewind. It couldn't be real. It felt so weightless. It felt like an idea, a particle of dust floating around in the air that hadn't landed yet. There was still time to catch it. There was still time to stop it, right? It had to be a mistake. I tried to swallow again, but my throat was huge. It was my dad who drove Maribel and Señora Rivera from the hospital back to the apartment. When he returned, my mom asked, Where are they? What do you mean? I drove them back. But I thought you would bring them here. They're going to bed. They can't stay in that apartment tonight. They can't be alone at a time like this. They're tired, Celia. You should have seen them. They need to sleep. But in that apartment? They have each other. That's not good enough. You're right. It's not. But what can we do? Listen to me. They were calm in the car on the way home. Neither of them said anything except to thank me for coming to get them. You can go over there first thing in the morning. Just let them get some sleep. They're our friends. Alma is a strong woman. They're going to be okay. My mom let out a shaky sigh. Tomorrow. You can go see them tomorrow. As soon as the sun came up, my mom and I went over. Señora Rivera answered the door, and my mom fell onto her in a crushing hug. ¡Qué horror! My mom cried into Señora Rivera's neck. I crept past the two of them to the bedroom, where through the open doorway, I saw Maribel sitting on the floor, her legs extended in a narrow V. I hesitated for a second, waiting to see if she would look up. I thought I might be able to tell from her expression whether it was okay for me to go in. But she was just moving her feet from side to side, staring absently at her toes. I went and sat down next to her, straightening my legs in the same way, and tapped the side of my sneaker against her foot. I didn't say anything, because there wasn't anything to say. I just sat, listening to the muffled sounds of our moms from the other room, low voices and sniffling, and even once or twice, what I could have sworn was laughter. After a long time, Maribel said, Do you think it was my fault? What happened to your dad? She nodded. I looked at her face. I could see that she was going to live with that question for a long time. I'd been living with it for less than a day myself, and it was tearing me up. But I said the only thing I could. No. It was just what happened. That's all. But we left Mexico because... No, Maribel. It was just what happened. It had nothing to do with you. Then was it our fault? I shook my head. But the only reason... Listen to me. You can't do that. You can't think like that. I was trying to comfort her, but both of us were trying to make sense of it. And sitting there, I started thinking, who can say whose fault it is? Who can say who set this whole thing in motion? Maybe it was Maribel. Maybe it was me. Maybe if I hadn't left school that day, or if I had answered my stupid phone when it rang, or if I hadn't fallen asleep in the car on the way home, none of this would have happened. But maybe if our parents hadn't forbidden us from seeing each other, I wouldn't have needed to steal her away like I did in the first place. Maybe if my dad had never bought that car, I wouldn't have had a way to get to the beach. Maybe it was my Tia Gloria's fault for giving my dad the money that allowed him to buy it. Maybe it was my Tio Esteban's fault for being a jerk who she would need to divorce to get that money. You could trace it back infinitely, all these different veins, but who knew which one led to the heart? And then again, maybe it had nothing to do with any of us. Maybe God had a plan, and he knew from the second the Rivera set foot here that he was putting them on a path toward this. Or maybe it really was completely random. Just something that happened. I didn't know it then, how close to the end I was with her. I mean, I should have been able to figure out that they'd go back to Mexico. I just didn't know how soon. I didn't know that the last time I'd see Maribel would be just a week later, when I'd find her sitting on the curb outside our building next to a full-size mattress. I went outside and sat next to her, the cement cold through my pants, the ground mostly clear by then, except for a few patches of dirty snow. "What are you doing out here?" I asked.
"Nothing."
"I thought you weren't allowed outside by yourself."
"My mommy's sleeping."
I peeked at the mattress. "On the floor?"
"She doesn't want to sleep in the bed anymore."
"Oh."
"We're leaving tomorrow," Maribel said.
"Tomorrow?" I said, looking at her.
"My mom wants to go back."
"So that's it?"
"She says we have to."
The melting snow trickled into the street grate next to us. I didn't know how to comprehend it, really, the fact that she was leaving. I mean, all my life people had been coming and going. Neighbors came and left. Kids at school showed up and were gone again the next year. But the difference was that none of them had been her. The green notebook I had gotten so used to seeing her carry around was on top of the mattress. Maribel picked it up and thrust it toward me.
"Here," she said.
"What? Did you write me a letter or something?" I asked. I was only half joking, hoping that maybe she had. But when I took the notebook and flipped through it, there was nothing but the lists she kept and her notes to herself. I closed the cover and fingered one of the rounded corners, feathered and frayed from overuse. I tried to hand it back to her, but she shook her head.
"You don't want it?" I asked. "Not anymore," she said.
It seemed like a measure of something, evidence of how far she'd come. She hadn't even talked that first time I'd seen her in the Dollar Tree, hadn't even made eye contact.
"You could come back one day," I said,
"or I could come there."
"Maybe."
"I could find you." Maribel shook her head.
"Finding is for things that are lost. You don't need to find me, Mayor."
She had her hands on her knees, and I touched my fingers to her knuckles, tracing the peaks and valleys, staring at her skin. The only girl who had ever liked me. It wasn't fair, I kept thinking, even though I had no right to complain. There were worse things, way worse, that happened in the world. If I hadn't known that before, I knew it now. They were gone by the time I got up the next morning. I didn't want to wake up early just to see them leave. I thought it would come pretty close to wrecking me to stand at the front window and watch them, two of them this time, walk out with their things in their arms. Besides, I could imagine it well enough. Maribel and her mom climbing into a truck similar to the one they had climbed out of 7 months earlier. Maribel with sleepy eyes and uncombed hair, sitting cross-legged on the seat, turning around and looking back for me.
But it would be okay, I told myself, that she wouldn't find me.
It was like she had said, "Finding is for things that are lost." We would be thousands of miles apart from now on. We would go on with our lives and get older and change and grow, but we would never have to look for each other. Inside each of us, I was pretty sure, was a place for the other. Nothing that had happened and nothing that would ever happen would make that less true.
Alma. I detached from myself. I saw my life as a spectator would from outside, from a distance so remote that I couldn't feel any of it. Señora Rivera, they said, we're sorry. The surgery was more complicated than we anticipated. There was nothing we could do. The translator at the hospital, a woman about my age with a wide, round face, cried as she delivered the news. I stared at her, hands trembling against her chest as she spoke. Mi más sentido pésame, she added, on behalf of herself. I reached out, gave her a hug. I saw myself doing this, but I didn't feel her shaking in my arms. I went to Maribel. I saw myself walking, but I didn't feel my feet upon the thin carpet. It's time to go, I told her. I saw myself talking, but I didn't feel the words crawling up through my throat. Is the surgery over? Maribel asked. Yes, I said. Get your things. Are we going to see him? She looked so hopeful, so nervous. She stared, waiting for me to say more. Are we going to see him? Are we going to see him? Had she really asked that? Are we going to see him? My God! I blinked and came back to myself. Are we going to see him? What a simple question to break my heart. No, I said. The word is fragile as an egg. Why not? My breath rose up through my lungs and emptied out again. Blood swept through my veins. My lips were dry. Is he resting? She asked. He was, in a manner of speaking. So I said, yes. Then, no. No, Maribel. Come here. I pulled her to my hip, feeling her wiry, warm body against mine. The surgery didn't go well, I said. Why? I took another breath. He didn't make it. Maribel closed her eyes, and I tightened my hold on her. What does that mean? She asked. I started, but I couldn't go on. There weren't enough words in Spanish. Not enough words in English, no matter how many classes I might have gone to. Not enough words in any language on earth, not the right words, nothing to match the depths of what I felt. My tongue fumbled against the back of my teeth, trying to give shape and sound to what had happened, struggling to explain when Maribel opened her eyes and said, he died? When I nodded, she let out a sound like a baby seal. I felt tears gathering at the edges of my eyes, and then, as quickly as a gasp, the world shrank, and I felt the ground open up beneath me. If I slept at all, I slept on the floor. Of course, that first night home, I didn't sleep. I lay on the floor next to the mattress and shivered under a blanket. I stood up in the middle of the night and looked at the bed to see if it had all been a dream. Maribel was tucked into her sleeping bag against the wall. But Arturo wasn't where he was supposed to be. He wasn't breathing long, rhythmic breaths, lying on his back. He wasn't in his undershirt and briefs. the comforter pulled to his chin. He wasn't there. I wrapped the blanket around me and stood at the window, my hair loose over my shoulders. If I turned my head enough, I could see the street and the traffic lights and an occasional semi-truck driving through town. I stood at the window for hours that first night. There was no comfort in it. Cold air slipped through the window sash and cut across my skin like razor blades. The caulk Arturo had tried to apply lay splintered in the seams. I stood there and thought about what must have happened, about what it must have been like. Although I tried very hard not to imagine what he must have felt. At the hospital, Officer Mora, the same officer I had spoken with at the station months earlier, tried to console me. He had knocked on our apartment door only minutes after Arturo had left. He had told me he was there about Maribel. He had asked, "Do you think it had something to do with that boy, the one you told me about?" I explained that Arturo had gone to find him. "He lives in Capitol Oaks," I said, and Officer Mora pulled the radio off the belt of his pants. He spoke into it in English, then clipped it back on and said, "I'll head over there now." Which is what he and another officer did. Only, by the time they arrived, it was too late. They found Arturo on the ground. They called for an ambulance. They found the boy and his father standing outside, a gun still in the father's hands. All of this, Officer Mora told me later at the hospital. He said that the boy's father, his name was Leon Miller, was in custody and would be charged. The boy, his name was Garrett, had witnessed the whole thing. "What happens now?" I asked. "Mr. Miller will probably be locked up for a long time. We're trying to determine if the kid was involved, but so far, he doesn't seem like it. We haven't been able to track down his mother yet, either." Officer Mora looked me in the eye. "I'm sorry about before," he said, "when you came to the station." His face was grave. "We're going to get justice for you now, though. I'll make sure of it." But it was only a word. Justice. It was only a concept. And it wasn't enough. As I stood at the window, I thought, if I saw the boy or his father now, I would take a gun and kill them myself. But of course, I didn't have a gun. I would throw my heavy winter boots at them. I would tear at their flesh with my teeth if I knew it would make a difference. But of course, it wouldn't make a difference. I leaned against the glass until daybreak, until the sky began to lighten over the earth. When it did, I thought, maybe it's over now. I turned back toward the bed to see if maybe, just maybe, he was stirring, stretching his arms overhead, and rubbing his eyes, to see if he would swing his legs over the side of the mattress and stand up and wander to the bathroom and shave his face. The smell of soap wafting out to the hallway. But when I turned, there was only the sheet thrown back, the mattress still depressed from where he had last lain. Celia came over the morning after. Everything to me now was either before or after, the way that previously my life had been divided by the accident, and sobbed into my shoulder. She apologized over and over. And though at first I mistook her apologies for condolences, I realized soon enough that she believed she had a role in what had happened. Or maybe that Mayor did, and I had to tell her, no, stop, please. Because while it was true that Mayor had taken Maribel away, he hadn't done this. Still, Celia kept coming every day, sometimes twice a day. She stayed for hours at a time. She brought empanadas and sugar breads wrapped in tin foil, arroz con pollo, and chicken soup packaged in plastic containers. She brought brown paper bags filled with clothes we didn't need and could barely use. She brought the prayer notes from Mass where Arturo had been listed that first Sunday in the bulletin. Father Finnegan did a beautiful service, Celia reported. He asked if there was anything he could do. He wanted me to remind you that his door is open, if you want to talk. I know. Celia put her hand on mine and left the prayer notes on the counter. On Monday, a woman from the hospital called to ask what I wanted to do with the body. The question was so absurd, it made me laugh. What do I want to do with it? I said. I want to bring it back to life. When I told this to Celia, she laughed too. Of course! What else would you want to do with it? Exactly. What did she say then? She said she was sorry, and that what she meant was whether I knew where I would like to bury him. So I said, I would not like to bury him. Oh, Alma! What questions, I said, shaking my head. Celia twisted the coffee mug in her hand. But you'll have to make a decision, won't you? I want him buried in Mexico, I said. I didn't tell her that I wanted him in the Panteón Municipal, where we could celebrate him on el Día de Muertos. I wanted to bake pan de muerto and prepare calabaza and tacha for him. I wanted to make an ofrenda with the cempasúchil flowers that grew in our yard. I wanted to put candles on his tomb. I wanted to honor him. I wanted him near me. Celia said, of course, he should be buried in Mexico. But the woman from the hospital said it would cost $5,000 to send his body there.
$5,000? ¡Qué escándalo! What are they going to do, build a house around him?
I told the woman, thank you, but I'll carry him to Mexico myself if I have to. Celia nodded. He has to go back with me. I need him. The inside of my nose, the whole inside of my face burned. I clenched my teeth until I could go on. I need him with me. Celia looked at me sadly.
So, you're going back.
I don't know what else to do. We're not even in status. The police know that now. They're going to send us back anyway if we don't leave ourselves. Where will you go?
We still have our house. My parents have been checking on it since we left. They're waiting for us. And then?
I don't know. I can barely even believe that the days will go on. It seems like it should all stop, somehow. But it doesn't, Celia said.
No, I said. For us, it doesn't.
I welcomed visitors. They made the passage of time tolerable. Gustavo Milojas came over with a bouquet of flowers in his arms.
They're marigolds, he said, handing them to me.
The girl at the flower shop said they were the right kind. I raised them to my face, inhaling their grassy scent. Come in, I said. Nelia Safon stopped by with a greeting card that had an illustration of seagulls flying over a crucifix. "I saw this in Walmart yesterday and thought of you," she said. "They have a good selection of cards in Spanish." I opened it and read, "Con el pésame más profundo y las bendiciones de Dios por la pérdida de alguien tan querido para ti." "Come in," I said. Mitch Alvarez knocked on our door, balancing a photograph on his open palm.
"I meant to give this to you sooner," he said. "I had it developed a while ago. It's from Christmas."
He handed me a photograph of Maribel, Arturo, and me, smiling in our winter coats in front of the Toros' door. Looking at it, the most exquisite pain seared across my chest. "Come in," I said. Fito arrived and stood in the doorway stricken, the skin on his face sagging. I waited for him to speak, and when he didn't, I said, "It's okay." Quisqueya never stopped by, but I saw her on the balcony one morning and raised a hand in greeting. She waved back, but hurried into her apartment. I understood. For her and any others who didn't come over, I understood. They simply didn't know what to say. Jose Mercado and his wife Inez came over without anything but condolences. And after I invited them in, they talked for an hour about what a good man Arturo was, and how much they had liked him, and how he had helped Jose carry paper bags of groceries into their apartment on more than one occasion. I hadn't known anything about the groceries, but I wasn't surprised either. It sounded just like Arturo. Not that he was a saint, I told them. He never cleaned his mustache clippings out of the sink. "That sounds familiar," Inez said, poking her husband in the side. She had long gray hair that she wore in a low bun. Her face was gentle and kind, pleated with wrinkles. "Arturo was stubborn too," I said. "He threw his back out once trying to raise cinder blocks over his head in a contest with his friends. This was in Pátzcuaro. I kept telling him he was lifting too many at once." "It's too heavy," I said. But he wouldn't listen to me. He just wanted to prove he could do it. "Men," Inez said, nodding in amusement. "You're more stubborn than me," Jose said. Inez looked at me. "You see? Stubborn even in his belief that he's not stubborn." I smiled. And in this way, the days passed. But when no one was there, no one but Maribel and me, the days vibrated with sadness. I had called Phyllis, the school district translator, and told her that I was keeping Maribel home with me. "I don't want her out of my sight," I said. "Is she ever coming back to school?" Phyllis asked. "No. Her teacher will be sorry to hear that." "I'll find something for her in Mexico," I said. "I know it won't be the same, but I'm not giving up on her." And because through the phone, I could feel Phyllis's sympathy, I added, "I promise." "She did well here," Phyllis said. "Maribel's a different girl now than when you arrived." "We're both different now," I said. When no one came over, Maribel and I watched television, hours and hours of it, finding small comfort in its ability to numb, to keep us from losing our minds. And yet, sometimes out of nowhere, Maribel asked where he was, or when he was getting home from work, and I had to remind her, "No, hija, no." I would hold her hands in mine and explain everything again.
I hugged her and let her cry as often as she wanted. Once, because repeating it was too much to bear, I let impatience get the best of me. I snapped. Stop asking me that! She looked at me so woefully that I collapsed in shame and said, I'm sorry. Again and again, repeating it until I hoped maybe she believed me. When I wasn't watching television or receiving guests, I spent time packing, preparing for the journey back to Pátzcuaro. I stood in our bedroom and looked at Arturo's clothes folded in neat towers on the floor. I took his shirts and his underwear, his socks and undershirts, and stuffed them all into plastic trash bags. I held up the one extra pair of jeans he had besides the ones he had been wearing that night. These were Wrangler, and he rarely wore them because the others were Levi's, which he claimed were better. But he'd kept the Wranglers for years anyway. They were stiff and smelled of detergent. I shoved them in the bag. I took his razor from the shower floor. Bits of his black hair still caked between the blades. I took his toothbrush from the sink counter and sucked on the bristles, trying to find the taste of him. But there was only the flavor of watery mint toothpaste. From behind the faucet, I took the scissors he used to trim his mustache and slipped them into the bag, too. I pulled the sheets off the bed with the idea that I could gather up the imprint of him and save it. I thought, I can unfurl the sheets on our old bed at home. I can lie in the creases formed by his body. I can sleep with him again. I plucked his used toothpicks out of the trash and clutched them in my hand before dropping them all into a bag. I watched them scatter and sink into the crevices of the things I had already packed. And then I came across his hat. The cowboy hat that he had worn for almost as long as I'd known him. At the hospital, they had given it to me when we left. I remembered when he had bought it, how proud he had been because it was a good hat. Finely woven and crisp. Now it was soft, and dirt had settled into the notches where the pale straw fibers crossed each other, especially in the crown. Parts of the brim were frayed. I put it over my face like a mask, feeling the sweatband, soft as felt, against my cheeks. I took a deep breath. And there he was. The smell of him. I closed my eyes and felt myself sway. There he was. Dios. I put the hat on my head. I learned something about grief. I had heard people say that when someone dies, it leaves a hole in the world. But it doesn't, I realized. Arturo was still everywhere. Something would happen, I would think. Wait until I tell Arturo. I kept turning around, expecting to see him. If he had disappeared completely, I thought, it might be easier. If I had no knowledge that he had ever existed, no evidence that he was ever a part of our lives, it might have been bearable. And how wrong that sounded. Part of our lives. As if he was something with boundaries, something that hadn't permeated us, flowed through us and in us and all around us.
I learned something about grief. When someone dies, it doesn't leave a hole. And that's the agony. 2 days before the scheduled burial, I started packing everything in the kitchen. I had spoken to someone at a funeral home that partnered with the hospital and confirmed, yes, we would lay Arturo to rest there. For a week, his body had been in the morgue waiting to be taken someplace. The burial felt wrong, but what could I do? I didn't have the money to fly him back. I had no way of getting it. I called my parents, who cried and cursed the heavens when they heard the news, but they had nothing either. I was told I couldn't drive him because it was against the law, and the authorities would take him at the border rather than let his body cross. I didn't know any other way to get him from here to there. It would have to be this. Arturo would be buried on Thursday morning at the All Saints Cemetery. He would be lowered into the ground in a casket I could barely afford. Even though I had instructed the funeral home to use the most inexpensive one they could. There's no shame in a pine box, I told him. In fact, I thought Arturo, who had been so humble, would have appreciated it. I put most of the silverware loose and clattering in bags. I packed the comal, the escopeta brush, the plastic baggies filled with spices we had brought, the molcajete and pestel. Except for the coffee mugs which I thought we would use until the very end, I packed every cup. And then I started with the dishes. I pulled the top plate from the stack. It was solid green and glazed with a clear lacquer. I held it in my hands and remembered when we had come how carefully I had set the plates in the cabinet once they were unpacked. How carefully I had set up our lives here. How naive I had been to think I could control any of it. And then I let the plate drop on the floor. It plummeted straight down from my open hands and landed with a crash, shards of ceramic bursting apart and skittering across the floor. What was that? Maribel asked from the other room. I didn't answer. I took another plate from the cabinet and dropped it too, watching it bloom at my feet. Then another. Then another. I thought suddenly, what is the meaning of all these things? All these bags and bags I've been packing. We could take everything we have with us. We could take every single thing that every single person in the world has ever had. But none of it would mean anything to me. Because no matter how much I took, and no matter how much I had for the rest of my life, I didn't have him anymore. I could have piled everything from here straight to heaven. None of it was him. Calmly, I pulled the rest of the plates out one by one. I dropped them all and watched the shards spin across the floor. I did this not in anger, but in the spirit of release. Vaguely, I noticed Maribel standing at the edge of the show. I heard her asking questions. I kept going. After I dropped the last of them, six in all, I looked up. Why did you do that? Maribel asked. It made me feel better. It was so loud. It's done now, I said. I swept the pieces into the trash can. I took most of the garbage bags that I had piled in the hallway out to the dumpster in the alley. Maribel helped me carry the mattress down to the parking lot where we left it.
Somebody else could have all of it if they wanted. I didn't need it anymore.
Celia came over early the next morning, dressed in her bathrobe and slippers. Her hair was in rollers. There was a chill in the air, and she shivered when I opened the door.
"You look awful," she said when she saw me.
"I haven't been sleeping."
"You should take medicine, like a Tylenol PM. I use it sometimes when I'm anxious."
"It works?"
"De maravilla."
"Come in," I told her. "Maribel's still sleeping."
"No. I need to go home and get dressed. We're going to 8 o'clock mass. Actually, you know what? You should come. We could go together."
"No, thank you."
"It might make you feel better to get out."
"Are you sure you don't want to come in?"
"I just came to give you something," Celia said.
She pulled a plain white envelope from her bathrobe pocket and handed it to me.
"What is it?"
"Look inside."
I lifted the flap and saw the edges of bills. There must have been 100 of them, open like a fan. "We took up a collection," she said. "Everyone chipped in. The teachers at Maribel School, the receptionist in the school district office. Oh, and the translator there, too. Arturo's co-workers at the mushroom farm, the manager at Gigante, a teacher from the community house, the translator, and some of the nurses from the hospital. The church made a nice donation, and Father Finnegan added more on top of that, plus everyone in the building." I stared at the money, overcome. "Mostly it's just a little bit from each person," Celia went on. $20 here, $10 there. I couldn't speak. But Rafa and I talked it over. "You know, we got some money recently from my sister." Of course, there was hardly any discussion. "The bigger bills are from us. So you can afford to fly Arturo back to Mexico. I hope it's not too late." The envelope felt weightless in my hand. "It's $5,132, she said.
"You did this?"
"We all did. I just mentioned the idea to a few people in the building first, but word spread. And before I knew it, people were contacting me to find out how they could contribute. People I didn't even know you knew." I stared at the envelope. Everyone loved him, Alma. Until that moment, tears had welled in my eyes. But I had beaten them back with furious blinking or distraction. Somehow, I had managed not to cry. But right then, I broke down. I fell on Celia and cried with more gratitude and happiness than I knew I was capable of feeling anymore. We left 2 days later, in a black pickup truck, driven by a man Rafael had found, who took people to and from the border. Apparently he had family in Texas, so he didn't mind the trip. "How much does he charge?" I asked Rafael.
"Nothing," Rafael said. "He's doing it as a favor to me. I used to give him free breakfast when he stopped at the diner on his way up 95. Don't worry about it."
I knew he was lying. It had to have cost something, but I let it go. Maribel and I sat in the back with a blanket draped over our laps. I had Arturo's hat on my head, my purse at my feet. Everything else, what little we were taking with us, was once again in plastic bags in the bed of the truck. The man was quiet. He looked like a gringo, but what did I know? He didn't introduce himself, nor turn on the radio, nor talk on his phone. He just chewed sunflower seeds that he kept in a plastic cup between his legs and flicked the shells out through the window, which he left rolled down. I was grateful for his indifference to us. To him, we could have been anyone.
We weren't people who were grieving or who needed to be taken care of or who were to be pitied. We were simply people who needed to get from one place to another. In a way, it was a relief to have the privacy of our mourning. It was early when we pulled out of the parking lot. The air was hazy. Feeble sunlight pressed through the filter of clouds. We drove past the pancake restaurant and the Red Lobster, the Dunkin' Donuts and the Rita's Italian Ice, the bowling alley and the Sears, the David's Bridal with its white gowns in the windows, and the Walmart next to the highway. Within minutes, we were on I-95 heading south. All morning, I stared out the window as the world rushed by. We drove over the Susquehanna River, where the water was a ribbon, wide and flat. We passed red barns and stone mills, small white houses with black shutters, and houses with wooden fences around their sprawling land. Everything silent and still. We passed roadside restaurants advertising breakfast specials and movie theaters with the showtimes listed on towering signs near the edge of the highway. We drove through the Baltimore Harbor Tunnel and then along the outskirts of Washington, D.C., where we passed a temple with gold spires striking up into the air. I tried not to think, but of course that was impossible. Why hadn't I simply told Arturo about the boy in the beginning? Would it have made a difference? There was no way to know the answer, and yet I remembered what Arturo had said, one of the last things he had told me, as if somehow he had known to offer me absolution in advance. Forgive yourself. Was that possible? Was it possible now, in this too? By noon, the sun was high in the blue sky. It shone like honey. It lay upon slender blades of grass and draped over the hood of the truck. I leaned my head against the warm window and looked at the road stretched out before us and at the land rolling away endlessly on either side. I looked at the billboards and at the trees between them, remembering how, when we had come 7 months ago, the trees had been full of green leaves and small berries, their branches so delicate and thin, bobbing in the breeze like something joyful. I stared at them now, leafless at the end of winter, and saw the same thing. To my surprise, I saw trees that looked happy. Trees that looked hopeful, their naked branches suspended in reach toward the sky. Spring would come soon, I thought, and fill them up again. We were 6 hours into a nearly 50-hour trip. At the end of it, we would be home, and Arturo would be there to meet us. I had canceled the arrangements with the funeral parlor and told him instead to prepare the casket for transport. I had called the consulate, filled out the papers, gotten them notarized, and translated into Spanish. I had paid everyone their money. I had done it all urgently, as if my life depended on it. Which, in a way, it did. But it was worth it. Arturo was going with us to the wide, silent lake and the butterfly fishermen who glided over its surface, to the red tile roofs and the rough adobe walls of both his childhood and mine, to the cobblestone streets and the brilliant sunshine and the arched doorways and the flowers spilling over people's roofs, to the market in La Boca, and the bench in Plaza Grande where the two of us ate ice cream on our first date, while the late day sun quavered above us, sliding down slowly against the curve of the sky. To the basilica, and the cathedral, and the painted store names in red and black. To the dirt and the wandering dogs. To our friends, and generations of our families. To that stupid glass bowl that he missed so much. To home. Our home. Somewhere in the mountains of Virginia, where the road grew narrower and hillier, Maribel complained that her stomach hurt. Without a word, the man pulled the truck over. "Come on out, hija," I told her, opening the back door. She threw up in the pebbles and the dirt along the shoulder while I held her hair and rubbed slow circles on her back. "A napkin," the man said in Spanish, holding a crumpled tissue across the seat to me. I wiped Maribel's mouth. "Are you okay?" I asked. "Do I have any in my hair?" I opened my palm and looked at the strands, long and dark and tangled. "No," I said. "I want to get it cut when we get home." "Your hair? It looks bad." I cupped my hand against the back of her head. "You look beautiful. And I want to dye it purple." Suddenly, out of nowhere, there she was. My Maribel. The one who once upon a time had painted her nails black and now wanted to dye her hair purple. The one determined to assert her independence and throw her arms around life. There she was again. The person Arturo and I had been waiting for, the reason for all of this. And as I looked at her, I saw that maybe she had been here all along. Not exactly the girl she used to be before the accident, which was the girl I thought I had been searching for, but my Maribel, brave and impetuous and kind. All this time, I had been buried too far under my guilt to see her. I had been preoccupied with getting us to the United States because I wanted it to make her whole again. I believed that I had lost my daughter, and that if I did the right things and brought us to the right place, I could recover the girl she used to be. What I didn't understand, what I suddenly realized now, was that if I stopped moving backwards, trying to recapture the past, there might be a future waiting for me, waiting for us. A future that would reveal itself if only I turned around and looked. And that once I did, I could start to move toward it. "We can call Angelina when we get back," I said. "You remember Angelina?" "From the salon," Maribel said. And I nodded, marveling that she knew. Only a few months earlier, that might not have been the case. I said, "It feels like a long time, doesn't it, that we've been gone?" "Yes," Maribel said. "It will be good to see it all again." The sky was dark by the time we got to Tennessee. I stared at the tall overhead highway lights as we drove beneath them. Loud semi-trucks passed us in the right lane, and each time I looked at the driver perched up high, wondering where he was going. After we'd eaten some of the crackers and drunk the bottled water that Celia had thrust into my arms when she and Rafael had said goodbye, Maribel fell asleep again, lulled by the sound of the road, and I closed my eyes too. When I woke in the morning, we were in Arkansas. I asked the man, and that's what he told me. I thought we would have been farther by then, but perhaps the driver had pulled over the truck for a time to sleep himself. The land in Arkansas was lime green and lush, flat and boundless. Tiny buds stood on the heads of blades of grass all over the fields. They swayed whenever there was a breeze or a gust of wind. I remembered that I had said to Arturo many months ago as we came through in the opposite direction that it was all so beautiful. "Every place is beautiful," he had said, "if you give it a chance." "You sound like a priest," I told him. "I could be a priest," he said. "And then what would happen to me?" I had teased him. We had been happy at certain moments during the drive, buoyed with optimism. "A priest can't be married, you know." Arturo looked very solemn. He put his hand on my knee. He said, "Then I could not be a priest." I remember I had laughed. After Arkansas, I knew we would drive down through Texas, past the hundreds of strip malls, and armadillos baking on the side of the road. We would cross the border into Mexico and take a series of buses back to Pátzcuaro, out of one world and into the next. Just like that. Like Arturo. Our journey would continue. And Arturo's would, too. Even though for now, he was headed to one destination, and Maribel and I to another. Later, much later, I would find my way to him. We would be in the same place again. That much I knew was true. I looked at Maribel next to me, staring absently out the window, the blanket balled on the seat between us. "How's your stomach?" I asked. She turned and gave me a small smile. "I'm fine," she said. It was what I had been waiting to hear the whole time.
Arturo Rivera. I was born in Pátzcuaro, Michoacán, Mexico. I lived there all my life until I came here. Other people from our town had gone north. Most of them left because they wanted a better life. That's what they said, a better life. But it wasn't like that for us. We had a good life, a beautiful life. We lived in a house that I built. We married in the town square when Alma and I were young, when people told us we didn't know anything yet about the world. But we knew, because the world to us was each other. And then we had Maribel, and our world grew larger. We came here for her. I think about God sometimes, whether he's watching us. Was this what he wanted? Was it all for some greater reason that I don't understand? Were we supposed to come here, to the United States? Is there something better waiting for us here that God in his infinite vision can see? Is there something ahead of us that will help all of this make sense finally? I don't know. I don't know the answers. I don't want to sound ungrateful. We are happy here in many ways. We've met good people. We haven't been here long, but the people in the building where we live have become like a family to us. The teachers at Maribel's school have helped her tremendously. She's getting better, they say. And Alma and I can tell. Maribel has a light in her eyes now. We see that. And nothing, not a single thing, brings us more joy. Maybe it's the instinct of every immigrant, born of necessity or of longing. Someplace else will be better than here. And the condition? If only I can get to that place. It took us a long time to be able to come. We applied and waited to be approved. We traveled for days. We left a lot of things behind. Not only physical objects, but our friends and, of course, our families. Pieces of ourselves. All for the chance to see that light in Maribel's eyes. It's been difficult, yes, but I would do it all again. People do what they have to in this life. We try to get from one end of it to the other, with dignity and with honor. We do the best we can. I'm overcome when I think about this place and about what it's given us. Maribel is getting stronger. I can see it. Every day, a little bit more. A safe area to live. Such good friends. It's incredible. One day, when we go back to Mexico and people ask me what it was like here, I will tell them those things. I will tell them all the ways I loved this country.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Book of Unknown Americans by Cristina Enriquez. This program was directed by Fred Sanders. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2014 by Cristina Enriquez. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.